Has it ever felt like you're doing everything right? You're eating healthy, you're working out, and yet your energy still crashes, or your mood swings hit out of nowhere, like a twist in a crime story that you didn't see coming. Listen, I've been there too, and what I've discovered is that many of these issues could be tied to hormonal imbalances, like a hidden criminal lurking in the background, throwing everything off track. But here's the good news. This is one mystery that you can solve with Happy Mammoth. There's no need for a long investigation. Just take the free 2-minute quiz from Happy Mammoth. You answer a few questions about what you're experiencing and where you're at in life, and you'll uncover the real culprit behind your hormonal symptoms. And the best part? After taking the quiz, you'll get a personalized recommendation to help you balance your hormones so you can finally feel like yourself again. According to a survey, after taking Hormone Harmony, 86% of women started to lose weight. 77% said that it improved their mood. And the biggest benefit? 100% of women surveyed said they're feeling like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ATTWG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ATTWG for 15% off today. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. And the styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. So I've been using Armoire, and I'm actually wearing one of their shirts right now as I'm recording this, and it's a great idea. You don't have to commit to buying the clothes, but you can really start to explore your own personal style. Like if there's a trend or something that you've been wanting to maybe try but not commit to, this is absolutely perfect. Because if you don't like it, you just put it back in the bag and get something else. Because we've all been there. You open your closet, and even though it's packed, you feel like you have nothing to wear. And with Armoire, that's a thing of the past. They make it effortless for all women to turn heads with stylish everyday looks. You can rent high-quality designer clothing for any occasion, and it's all tailored to your personal style. Plus, you don't have to do laundry, and you don't have to go shopping. It truly could not be any easier. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month, which is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/ATTWG. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/ATTWG to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I was very wrong. If you remember, I was worried about my brain and not my cardiovascular health. And it turns out my brain's fine, but my cardiovascular health needs work. But luckily, my biological age was really right on track with my actual age, which is good because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means that you have a lot of control over it. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging, and it was eye-opening. And I will say, like, I definitely picked up the workouts after I learned that my cardiovascular health isn't as good as I thought it was. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, and it was just a quick, painless finger prick. that I made Ethan do because I was too scared. You send it off in a tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use ATTWG at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
Darkcast Network, the light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
On March 28th, 2023, the trial of Trizelle and Jacqueline West began. The couple stands accused of killing their two adopted sons, Orin and Orson West, named Sincere and Classic at birth. They were 4 and 3 at the time. According to the parents, the boys went missing from their California City, California backyard on December 21st, 2020. The prosecution contends that the brothers had already been dead for months before that 911 call was made. Over the course of several weeks, the prosecution laid out its case, which, absent the boys' bodies or other physical evidence, hinges on a star witness, Trizelle and Jacqueline's 12-year-old son. We covered the prosecution's case in our last episode, so now, with both sides having rested their cases, we're bringing you Trizelle and Jacqueline's defense. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Orin and Orson West and the trial of Trizelle and Jacqueline West. I'm Kona Gallagher, and this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining me once again. Ethan is traveling for work, so this is going to be a solo show, unfortunately. It's actually kind of a bummer because I did want to talk to him about this, but this is part two of our coverage of this trial, so you definitely want to listen to last week's episode first. If you're a new listener, you can also listen to our previous coverage of this case. Our first episode was our season 3 premiere, and we did a follow-up on March 9th, 2022, after Jacqueline and Trizelle's arrest. Now, this episode is going to be shorter, one, because it's just me, and two, because while the prosecution took 18 days to lay out their case, the defense took 3. So there's just not as much to talk about, but, you know, there is obviously a lot to talk about in the totality of this case. So let's get into what the defense had to say. Based on the cross-examination of several of the prosecution's witnesses, we learned that one of the main tenets of the defense was going to be police's tunnel vision. They contend that Trizelle and Jacqueline were looked at as suspects instead of grieving parents too early, and that this harmed the investigation. We got hints of the second arm of the defense as well, but Jacqueline's attorney, Alexia Torres-Stallings, laid it out clearly in her opening statement. Unlike Trizelle's attorney, she reserved her opening statement until after the prosecution rested. So we did play clips from both the prosecution's opening statement and Timothy Hennessy's opening statement. He is Trizelle's attorney. But now we're going to get into Alexia Torres-Stallings, Jacqueline's attorney's statement. In it, she went after the people who interviewed the Wests' other four children, saying, quote, And individuals should have some kind of training when they speak with children in order to prevent any type of implantation that can then result in false allegations and false memories. And this is really the cornerstone of Tora Stallings' argument. And it seems as though she and Hennessy worked together and that Hennessy was really trying to hammer home the inconsistencies in the investigation and the problems with that. And he was more going after the police while Tora Stallings focused on going after the people who interviewed the children and the children's testimony.
The fact that an individual should have some type of training when they speak with children in order to prevent any type of implantation that can then result in false allegations or false memory.
She also goes on to say that even after the video had been enhanced a few times, that it really just was not clear enough to definitively say whether or not the youngest two boys were in there.
When you look at the still image that is going to be provided to you, it is apparent that there is an individual carrying something or someone.
Personally, I go back to what I said when we were first covering this case. Like, to me, it's not the video itself or what it shows. Yeah, to me, it also only looks like four kids going, but it's more that from the time that they closed the doors to the time that they pulled away, in my opinion, as a mom who has been struggling with, you know, car seats for years, like there just wasn't enough time to get two toddlers buckled in and leave. Certainly not hard evidence or scientific by any stretch of the imagination. But to me, like, that was more compelling of a reason that they were not in the van than what I actually saw on the video in terms of people getting in. The second day of the defense's case focused on discrediting the prosecution's star witness, the West's eldest son. Now, remember, he's 12 years old now. He was only 10 when the boys disappeared. They read the entire hour-long testimony that he had given to the grand jury last year, so presumably he was about 11. Now, in this testimony to the grand jury, he initially did say that he had seen both of the brothers right before Christmas, specifically that the last time he had seen them was in the van on December 19th. This is from NBC affiliate KGET. Quote, "It wasn't until about 30 minutes into his testimony, after being shown an earlier interview with a social worker, that the boy told the grand jury he heard his brother Oren, 4, gagging one night, and the next day his parents told him he had died. As questioning continued, he said he hadn't seen his youngest brother Orson, 3, for a long time before he and Oren were reported missing, and he believed Orson had been staying at a grandmother's house," end quote. The defense, in my opinion, hasn't been scoring a whole lot of points throughout this trial, but showing that the oldest son did give conflicting statements, that is definitely a point in their favor. On Wednesday, May 10th, the defense called a psychologist to the stand who testified that the West children were improperly questioned using coercive and suggestive techniques, which could have led to false memories being implanted. Dr. Susan Napolitano told the jury, quote, "There was a great deal of social pressure on this child during this interview," end quote. She said that it's unusual for a child to be questioned by a forensic psychologist more than once, and that the eldest son in this case was questioned by social worker Sunia Barton 3 times. She admitted that Ms. Barton did a lot of things right in her interviews, but did offer specific criticisms, saying that Barton's questioning was often, quote, "extremely leading," and that she put peer pressure on the child by telling him what his brothers had said and then asking him what he thought. And she said that this pressured him to giving a similar response as his brothers. She gave several more specific examples as to the problem she had with this questioning.
And the prosecution's cross-examination really just kind of focused on like, well, did you write a report? She said no. Why not? She says I wasn't asked to write a report. She did have a PowerPoint presentation that she used during her testimony. And, you know, then they just basically asked about her credentials and like why she charged so much money for this. So, again, nothing huge really there on the cross-examination. After Dr. Napolitano's testimony, the defense rested. The Wests did not testify in their own defense, and they called no other witnesses. It seems as though the strategy of Tim Hennessy, Trizell's attorney, was to sow the seeds of reasonable doubt by suggesting other perpetrators, including the boy's biological parents or one of the many sex offenders who lived nearby. And the goal of Jacqueline's attorney was really to discredit the testimony of the West children and the interviewers specifically. And I do want to make clear that while I say she was trying to discredit the West children, I'm not saying that in a malicious way. But, you know, her opinion is that because of the way the interviews were conducted, that these false memories could have been implanted and that it's not as though the children were lying in that, you know, they were deliberately telling untruths. They thought they were telling the truth, but their version of the truth was put there by the people who interviewed them. After both sides rested, the jury was given instructions and then closing arguments were presented on May 16th. In his closing arguments, which lasted about 2 hours, prosecutor Eric Smith got straight to the point.
Trizell and Jacqueline have no moral fiber. They killed two kids.
And while I'm asking you to trust in the system is because the jury is the failsafe here.
He went on to say that after Oren's death, Jacqueline and Trizell panicked because they wanted to continue to get money from the state for adopting the boys.
Parent has a legal duty. Under the law, you are required to help your child.
After the move to Cal City, he says that they planned to murder Orson the night before Trizell's mother, Wanda, came to visit. That was the night their oldest son said he heard what he described as a soap bottle dropping in the bathroom.
Process of moving. Questions are going to be asked. They have to come up with something. So the night before Wanda comes, they hatch the plan. They kill Orson. And they set it up. They got 3 months. Discard the bodies. Get rid of phones. Get new phone numbers.
The defense countered that Orn and Orson's disappearance wasn't a conspiracy on the part of the Wests. According to them, the only conspiracy was on the part of police who conspired to blame the Wests instead of looking at other viable suspects.
Man's got no moral fiber? Look how he's looking at these kids. He's just going to kill that kid for money? The whole theory just doesn't even add up. One of the boys dies because you might have beaten him so bad or you might have given him a shake. So then you just get rid of the other one because then that would be obvious if you just had one kid. We can't convict two people just so we can pretend that those two boys didn't get took.
Hennessy's argument is basically that the prosecution simply did not meet the burden of proof to convict two people of murder. Or as he said in that clip we just listened to, you know, you can't just convince people that they killed their sons and pretend that they didn't get took. In her closing statement, Tora Stallings, she kind of went to the technical aspects of everything and reiterated the jury instructions that said that, you know, how they were really supposed to weigh the testimony that they had heard. And, you know, she also, again, criticized the investigation, saying that the lack of reports and that the lack of looking at other avenues other than the West's was, quote, a slap in the face. Hennessy also said that the entire investigation was, quote, like a bad game of telephone where everyone just listens to what Hansen has told them, end quote. And Officer Hansen is one of the leading investigators on this case. And we kind of talked about his testimony in the last episode. You know, closing arguments are, of course, the attorney's big chance to leave lasting impressions on the jury. Now, unfortunately, I don't have the clip of Hennessy saying what I believe, you know, would leave a lasting impression. But the quote is, They're scared to admit they were wrong. They just assumed the bodies would show up and the Wests would confess. End quote. For the prosecution's part, this is what Smith had to say.
Miscalculated. Because they didn't know law enforcement can go and talk to their kids.
To me, that's what this case really comes down to. And I think he's right. I think that Trezell and Jacqueline were counting on them not being able to talk to their children. All right. So that is the end of, like, you know, the actual testimony and everything. So let's get into opinion time. If you've listened to all of the episodes that we've done on Orrin and Orson West, I mean, you can tell that I suspected Trezell and Jacqueline from the very beginning. Like, the math was not mathing on their story. None of it made sense. And that's tough, right? Because, you know, you really, really want to believe the parents in a situation like that. And you don't want to believe that they could have done something to these little boys. But based on the stories of not only the West's children, but I think the testimony that we talked about last week from their former foster child, which details abuse that had been present in the home for years, because, you know, this kid lived with them 6 years ago, well before Orrin and Orson ever came into the picture. And there was abuse present in the home then. The way the children talk about Orrin and Orson, it seems as though they weren't really a part of the family. It seems as though the little boys were kind of kept separate, that the four children were more of a unit, and then Orrin and Orson were their own unit. And I think that can go a long way in explaining why the four surviving children were a little bit unclear on when they had last seen Orrin and Orson, right? You know, especially because they were all younger. Like, the oldest one was 10. So the other three children were younger than that. And, you know, kids don't have great senses of time. Everything was either 5 minutes or 50 years ago to them. I do think that Dr. Napoliano did make some good points in terms of the issues with the interviews of the children. I think that she probably is correct in that there is a degree of confirmation bias present here, and that when the social worker went in, you know, they already had Trezell and Jacqueline as suspects in their mind. And that I think that there is a good chance that the way the questions had been asked did lead the children to answer in particular ways. However, I don't think this is a false confession type situation, right? I mean, for those of you who watched Making a Murderer, for instance, like, I go back to the Brendan Dassey interview, and that was just so leading and just such a clear cut case of a false confession. And it doesn't seem like that's exactly what this was. I think that these kids loved their parents. I think they were afraid of being taken away. And they didn't say anything for 3 months because they didn't want to be taken away. They didn't want to be separated. I believe the oldest child when he says that he saw Orrin die. Maybe all of the details are not correct, but when he says that his parents told him that he couldn't tell anybody, I believe him. I believe that is true. And I believe him when he says that Orson was there for only a short period of time. And that's backed up by an adult, right? The realtor. The realtor had never seen Orrin, but he did see Orson at the house on September 11th when he went to drop the keys off. So we have a corroborating witness saying that Orson was there for at least a short period of time. The defense also tried to explain away the fact that the family hadn't seen the boys in months, by saying it was COVID. And yeah, like, obviously that's true, but they had seen the older children more recently. And to me, the big, big thing is the mom's testimony. It was Trizelle's mom and Jacqueline's mom, and saying how Trizelle and Jacqueline had given them conflicting stories. Trizelle's mom said that she was told that Jacqueline's mom was watching the little boys when she was there on December 19th. And Jacqueline said, no, I hadn't seen them in months. There's no other reasonable explanation for Trizelle and Jacqueline to be lying about that. I'm recording this right now on May 18th. The jury went into deliberation yesterday, May 17th. As of this moment, we do not have a verdict. I'm going to try to plug in that at the end of this episode if we get this before I need to put it up. I am honestly a little shocked that the jury hasn't come back yet, though it is not even 8 a.m. in California yet. So they are clearly not in session at this point. So I will put that in. So if there's a little bit of, you know, sound weirdness, it's because I'm probably going to just be recording it on my phone or something, because I am also leaving town. But this case is just absolutely gut-wrenching. These boys were taken out of a home that was seemingly a dangerous situation and then put into a home that was even more dangerous for them. It doesn't seem as though they were treated very well during the short time they were on Earth. I just sincerely, sincerely hope that they can at least get some measure of justice here.
Hey there, this is Kona. I'm currently recording this on my phone in a closet that's a little scary in Austin, Texas. I wanted to tack this on to the end of the episode because on May 19th, Trizelle and Jacqueline West were found guilty of 5 of the 7 charges that they were facing, including murder. The jury was deadlocked on 2 of the charges, so they weren't found not guilty of those charges. The jury could not come to a decision. They hung 8-4 for guilt on the conspiracy charge and 10-2 for guilt on the murder charge, but they were found guilty of second-degree murder, involuntary manslaughter, and child cruelty regarding Oren, but it was the second-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder in connection with Orson's death that the jury was deadlocked on. Second-degree murder carries a prison sentence of 15 years to life. They were also convicted of falsely reporting an emergency. Sentencing is set for July 13th, and that's when Prosecutor Eric Smith is going to announce whether or not they will retry the Wests on those 2 charges that the jury was deadlocked. My guess is, you know, if this sentence is high enough, they probably won't bother, but who knows? We'll have to wait till July 13th to see that. I'm not shocked by the guilty verdict. I think that that was the correct verdict. And it's just really a sad, sad case all around.
You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com. Don't forget to like us on social media. We're on Facebook at And Then They Were Gone Pod and on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at ATTWGPod. Also, if you would like to request we cover a case, there is a link in the show notes for you to do that. And if you like what we're doing, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple, especially if you'd like to counteract the ones who say that we are too woke. It will make me feel better, and it'll also help new listeners find us. And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode. And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.